In the lectures that we've done so far, we've tried to give you as much background as we could about the nature of the poem so that when we take the journey along with Dante the Pilgrim, we will be well equipped. Well, today we start that journey, and we started by going directly to hell. And pretty much what we'd like to do for our journey is to go along with the pilgrim, and as he learns things in process, so too will we. But we do need a little bit of a map to orient ourselves as well. You may remember that in an earlier lecture we mentioned that in order to be a member of Dante's afterlife, it was necessary to be dead, and to be dead by the year 1300. What we want to do now is to suggest that you need something else to be a member of the afterlife, part one, hell. When we ask this to our students, what do you need to be a member of the afterlife in hell? Inevitably, a lot of hands go up and they say, you need to be a sinner. And we say, yeah, that's true, but that's only part of the answer. There's another part that is equally important. They think for a while, occasionally somebody gets it. You have to be a sinner who is unrepentant. All right, now, it's important to see that in terms of what happens in the other parts of the Commedia, because the people that we meet there, too, some of them were sinners, and some of them were pretty famous at sinning, but they did repent, and that makes all of the difference. So it's important for what we see later on, but it's also very important for what we're going to see in hell, because the whole idea of not being repentant really does determine the way all of these characters are going to interact with Dante. So we start off then by saying we're going to a place with the pilgrim where Dante is going to meet unrepentant sinners.
We need to say a word about the geography of hell. Where is it we're actually going in this journey? Well, for one thing, we're going down to the center of the earth. Don't worry, in Dante's day, no educated person thought the world was flat. So if you learned that about Columbus in 1492, we've got to get this out of our heads, because people from the ancient Greeks on knew better. So at any rate, we're going to go down through a series of concentric circles in a highly articulated design that Dante creates. In fact, we're going to go through 9 circles of hell. And as much as it sounds like, as we read Dante's description, he's describing a real place and giving us a lot of details. This sort of reminds me of that back on Earth. We also need to remember that it's not just a physical geography, it is a moral geography. As we journey toward the bottom of hell, toward the center of the earth where we meet Satan, the sinners and the sins are more serious. Furthermore, when we read those descriptions of the various tortures and punishments, don't just see them as what new idea can Dante come up with as a little grosser than the last one. That would be a totally wrong way to approach it. But rather, how can we read the geography and the punishments as a way of understanding the very nature of the sin that this person has committed and, as Ron said, not repented?
Again, in terms of the kind of major contours of hell, Dante deals with 3 separate kinds of moral failure, which he names incontinence, violence, and fraud. There are a lot of different ways to think about this. To me, the most useful and in many ways the most convenient is to think about it as a kind of inversion of the classical virtues of moderation, of courage, and of wisdom, so that the inversion of the virtue of moderation is incontinence. We'll find out later that the one-line definition of that is subjecting reason to desire. The inversion of courage turns out to be violence, and the inversion of wisdom, the virtue of the intellect, turns out to be fraud. Now, it's sort of interesting also to think about this in terms of the 4th important classical virtue, which was justice. Plato tells us, a long time before Dante, that if you have the other 3, justice is going to be the well-regulated association of those 3 other virtues. Okay? Therefore, in the lack of all of those virtues, what we're going to have is the unjust city, which Dante is creating in this inversion, in this funnel that Bill talks about. And as Bill says, the deeper the journey, the more serious the sin that he encounters there.
Another way we could talk about the progression, if you will, of sins is to suggest that what Dante's concerned about is not what we would think of as a criminal justice system. Which thing on earth deserves the most years in prison or whatever? It's not that kind of system at all. Dante asks a fundamental question. What does it mean to be human? How does being human make us different than the other things that God created? And one answer, again, goes back far before Dante, is that humans have intellect, the faculty of knowing, and will, the faculty of choosing. And as we're going to see, the sinners toward the top of hell are going to be those who essentially ignore those specifically human qualities. And the further we go down, the more we're going to see the conscious perversion of the human faculties of intellect and will.
Now, who is it that we're going to see when we get down there? We've already given some pretty substantial clues in that direction. We've suggested, for example, that Dante the poet doesn't really make a distinction between real people and fictional people. We'll see people who really did exist, and we'll also see people who are characters in works of literature, in mythology, and so on. We'll see figures who are from history, and we will also see figures, as we explained in some detail, who are local. That is to say, who would have perhaps faded into oblivion were it not for the fact that Dante kind of keeps them alive for us in the poem. So one of the things to keep in mind is that the poem itself is this balance between concerns which are universal and concerns which are local. And going back and forth between these two is one of the chief things that we ought to be looking for, and one of the things that makes this such a fascinating journey. So there's this tremendous variety in when they lived and what kind of people they are. What is it that all of these sinners have in common? Well, again, we go back to the definition. They're there because they are unrepentant. And because they're unrepentant, they have this overwhelming compulsion, really. It's who they are. They have this overwhelming compulsion to justify what they've done, to put the blame for the very actions that got them there somewhere else. And they do this in all kinds of interesting and subtle ways. One of our jobs, along with the job of Dante the pilgrim, is to try and unpack the kind of justifications that these sinners give for the deeds that they did back on earth and that got them to where they are today.
And if you find yourself scratching your head over one of these sort of convincing speeches given by one of the sinners, you say, really, am I supposed to buy this? One of the things that should give you comfort is that Dante the pilgrim, the character that Dante the poet creates, is going to mess up a lot. He's going to misunderstand a lot. He's going to respond wrongly a lot. It's going to take a while for him to get oriented. And even as he begins to understand things, he will have lapses. So you should not be discouraged if, in fact, you say, boy, I'm convinced this sinner really seems like, you know, he or she shouldn't be there. We hope to guide you through some of that and help get over some of those bumps. But it's important for you to have some of those bumps. It's important to have the experience that Dante the Pilgrim had. It's a tough job decoding some very clever, very smart people we're going to meet in hell.
Another way to take a look at what Bill has just said, one of the issues that Dante the poet has to deal with is that ultimately, if sin is destructive, and if it's destructive of those who commit it above all, after all, they're here now and suffering for it, then why is it that it's such a popular game? Okay, that is, why is it that so many people fall victim, if you will, to these sins? Well, one of the things that the poet needs to do is not only talk about the ultimate destructiveness of the sin, but also the kind of surface veneer of attractiveness that caused them to sort of think it was really going to be fun. Okay? And that veneer of attractiveness, especially at the beginning of hell, is also going to be there in the sinner's attempt to justify themselves. And if you combine that with the fact that they have lost a kind of self-knowledge. We're told by Virgil after they actually get into the, you know, into the gates of hell that you have to be careful because here are the people who have lost the good of intellect. Okay? And what that really turns out to be, what does it mean to lose the good of intellect, is the subject for the whole Inferno. But I think part of what it means is that they're able to tell a good story, but only within certain very narrow terms. They are people who see trees but don't see anything at all of the forest. Okay? So when we go through hell, these are some of the things that we ought to keep in mind, or better yet, these are things that we forget only at our peril. Our tendency, as Bill points out, is going to be, along with Dante, the pilgrim, to sympathize, all right, with the sinners there. But we need to remind ourselves that the pilgrim that we see is somebody who wakes up in a dark wood of error, in a dark wood. And with that as a kind of introduction, we can turn to the text itself.
Dante's Divine Comedy, Inferno, Canto 1, Line 1. Midway along the journey of our life, I woke to find myself in a dark wood, for I had wandered off from the straight path. How hard it is to tell what it was like, the wood of wilderness, savage and stubborn. The thought of it brings back all my old fears, a bitter place. Death could scarce be bitterer. But if I would show the good that came of it, I must talk about things other than the good. How I entered there, I cannot truly say. I had become so sleepy at the moment when I first strayed, leaving the path of truth.
So, he's in a dark wood. It's pretty clear that he's very disoriented. He can't tell us what it was like, really, and he can't tell us how he got there. I guess the easiest explanation for that would be, if he could, he'd know how to get out. If he could, it really wouldn't be this condition of disorientation. But it's also interesting to think about all of the different ways in which you can look at what the pilgrim is telling us about himself. Is this primarily about a kind of moral failure on his part? Is this primarily what we would consider a kind of midlife crisis? After all, as we've already seen, this is exactly his midlife. Seems like as good a time as any to have a midlife crisis. Is it some combination of that? Is it other things? Well, again, it's left somewhat vague, but I think what the poet is trying to say is that that's part of the problem, that there's really no precise way or more precise way to define this terrible sense that he has of not knowing where he is, of where he's going, or even maybe where he's coming from.
To me, one modern author that helps to focus in on the condition of Dante the Pilgrim is Hannah Arendt, the 20th century philosopher. She talks about, with regard to elements of the Holocaust, the banality of evil. And I think in some ways that's what Dante's expressing. It's not that he's just done some terrible thing and wakes up and says, gosh, I shouldn't have done that. It's that at some moment he sort of looks at himself, at his own story, and says, this isn't who I set out to be. This isn't what I meant to do. This isn't matching up very well with some of the things I wanted to do and some of the things I claim to be in favor of, some of the things I value. How did that happen? It didn't happen in one great big leap, but presumably it happened in increments. And I think anybody, perhaps more our age than our students, but almost anybody can identify with that notion that every now and then you just say, how did I get here? How did I end up defending this? How did I end up acting this way? This isn't, I think, who I am. This isn't what I set out to be. And I think that sense of being disoriented here is very much a part of that notion of the banality of evil.
And of course, if the question is, number one, how did I get here? Question number two is, how do I get out? And it seems like he has an easy answer to that question in the lines that immediately follow. He looks up, sees the sun. I raised my head and saw the hilltop shawled in morning rays of light sent from the planet that leads men straight ahead on every road. And then only did terror start subsiding in my heart's lake, which rose to heights of fear that night I spent in deepest desperation. So he talks about trying to kind of, he sees the sun, now he's going to try and climb to it. I rested my tired body there a while and then began to climb the barren slope. I dragged my stronger foot and limped along. And just as he's about to make the climb, he's interrupted.
In fact, as he continues, he's interrupted three times by three different animals, a leopard, a lion, and a wolf, which, by the way, in Italian, all begin with the letter L. There's a beautiful sound to those three animals in Italian. And what he discovers is that he simply can't get to the light on his own. These beasts will keep him from doing it. Dante scholars have argued around the periphery of what these stand for, but they all agree virtually that they stand for sin in general and the three categories of sin that Ron's already described: incontinence, violence, and fraud. So here's somebody who is in this sort of moral and spiritual disorientation who says, I think I can handle this on my own. And he turns out to be wrong.
And so it would be a very short poem. Instead of the 14,000 lines we have, we could have like 32, sees the beast, and he sort of goes back, right, back, as he says, to where the sun is mute. But what happens is that somebody comes to rescue him. And the second part of this first canto consists of Dante's meeting with the poet Virgil, the introduction of Dante to Virgil, the kind of surprise, the shock, all right, of Dante meeting Virgil, and then the beginning of the process whereby he's going to get out of this mess, when Virgil basically tells Dante he has been sent, he is part of a heaven-sent mission to help Dante get out of this mess. Now, there's an awful lot to say about this, but let's start with the fact that it means that Dante's quote-unquote salvation, Dante's ability to rescue himself here, doesn't come from within himself. It comes from help that he receives from the outside.
We would probably, in theological terminology, call this grace. That is to say, it is something free and undeserved. And toward the end of Canto 1 and in Canto 2, Virgil explains this process, beginning with the Virgin Mary, through St. Lucy, and on to a woman named Beatrice, whom we've talked about before. And Beatrice actually sort of breaks the rules, as Virgil explains, comes down into limbo, the upper part of hell, where Virgil lives eternally, and says, Virgil, I got a job for you. I want you to go get this guy who's lost in a dark wood, and I want you to take him on a journey through the entire afterlife. Virgil doesn't take him all the way there. Virgil takes him about two-thirds of the way. I'll meet you later on, and I'll take over at a certain point. But he's got to go through this journey. He's so messed up. Things are so bad that sort of the normal ways you might try to correct people simply won't work. He's too far gone for sort of the normal remedies. He really needs this extraordinary journey.
Yeah. Notice that it also is sort of interesting when Dante and Virgil meet here that if you have Virgil as the one who's going to take him out of this, Dante himself says, well, that's really cool because you're the poet that I learned so much of my own writing style from. You're an appropriate guide. But the fact is that Virgil is there to help Dante because others have come to Virgil and made him an offer he couldn't really refuse. So we have Dante and Virgil hooked up, and they'll stay that way for 68 more cantos. But it's also interesting that Virgil's job is not yet done in terms of saying, all right, it's a done deal, sign on the dotted line, because Dante seems to be quite reluctant to take the journey even after Virgil says, I'm here to help you out, because, of course, he says, you got to go another way. So you wanted to climb up, can't do that. The way to salvation for you, before you can even start thinking about going up, is to go down first. You've got to get down into the pit before you can rise. Well, in theory, that sounds like a good idea, but the more Dante begins to think about it, the more he gets cold feet, gets a little bit terrified, and tries to back out. And so Virgil's job is, you know, ultimately to accompany Dante, but before he does that, he has to kind of convince him to do it. At the beginning of the second canto, there's this wonderful stuff going on where Dante attempts to sort of weenie out of the deal, and Virgil convinces him that he has to go and do it.
Again, that arm twisting takes a while, but finally Dante does go. And at the beginning of Canto 3, we actually enter hell. There's a formal gate. Sort of looks like one of those Roman arches that survives in downtown Rome and other places. And the inscription on the gate contains the most single important line, or at least the most famous line, of the Commedia. It's worthwhile looking at that inscription, which is at the beginning of Inferno 3. I am the way into the doleful city. I am the way into eternal grief. I am the way to a forsaken race. justice it was that moved my great creator. Divine omnipotence created me, and highest wisdom joined with primal love. Before me nothing but eternal things were made, and I shall last eternally. Abandon every hope, all you who enter.
Now, of course, the thing that's most interesting about it from our point of view is that Dante is coming with Virgil as a kind of temporary visitor, not a permanent inhabitant. And so that last bit of advice, abandon all hope, doesn't really apply to him in that he has every expectation and promise of getting out. But it must be a pretty scary experience for the pilgrim to embark upon the journey, and that's what he sees as he begins. So there's a sense in which he's going to have to really, if not abandon hope, at least abandon his fear in a very big-time way in order to kind of even begin to undertake what's going to happen once he's through the gates, where all of a sudden the action really begins to speed up and things to begin to happen to the pilgrim, or at least he sees things all around him happening at a pretty breakneck pace.
It's interesting that Dante's first response to that passage through the gate and to those nine lines that are inscribed on the gate is, these words I see are cruel. This is a sign for us that we don't necessarily have to understand Dante the Pilgrim as our best guide right now. Because, in fact, the arch itself says this is a place of justice. And in some sense, with Dante saying these words are cruel, he seems not to accept that principle, certainly not accept it in its entirety. That's a sign to us that we need to remember he's just left the dark wood. He's got an awful lot of learning to do. We do not accept the pilgrim's analysis of things at face value.
Now, he's there. He's in hell. Let the games begin. Except that the first place is kind of an interesting anteroom or vestibule to hell where a very unusual group is being punished. They haven't committed any specific sin, but they haven't done anything good either. In fact, they haven't done much of anything. In this anteroom, what we find are the folks who have refused to take a stand on anything when they were still alive. They're the first inhabitants of the afterlife that Dante meets, and essentially have to figure out what to do with these folks. What does it mean to have all of these people running around who have not taken any stand, made any decision, done anything at all back in their own life?
These neutrals are, in fact, important folks for us to meet up with because I think they sort of bring experience that we understand. But ultimately, when we don't take a stand on anything, we simply say, gee, I'm not going to talk about that, or, you know, I'll keep my opinions to myself, or, you know, I'm not going to follow that cause or this cause. What we're essentially saying is, I care more about me than anything else. If I take a stand, somebody's going to dislike me. If I take a stand, I might be on the losing side, and that's not good for me. And therefore, while we might think about neutrality as a kind of, you know, Olympian view of judging everything carefully and rationally, Dante's not opposed to judging things rationally, mind you, but what Dante fears are those who ultimately will not take stands are those who really stand only for themselves. And therefore, part of their punishment is Dante never names any of them. They are condemned to a kind of anonymity in hell. And that way of looking at this very first set of sinners is a clue to the way we're going to see group after group of sinners' punishment. What they chose, in some real way, is what they get with, as Ron said earlier, that nice veneer that sometimes makes sin attractive to us taken away.
And of course, also, this is another way for the poet to let us know that refusing to choose really is a choice. That the sense that you're not choosing is a kind of illusion, a kind of scam that you're playing, possibly on yourself, but a scam definitely, because not taking a stand, not making a choice, is going to have consequences. And another one of the things that we pick up here is that the poem is very concerned with showing the sin, not only in terms of what it is in itself, what it does to the sinner, but what other consequences exist, how doing things, or in this case not doing things, really sets out a kind of pattern of reverberations where a lot of people are implicated in what is done. And that, too, is present as one of the kind of preliminary lessons that we learn about this section of hell.
At the end of Canto 3, we go down to the next step, and that is the first of these formal nine circles. And yet it's very different than the eight circles we will subsequently pass through, because here the punishment is not so obvious. There are no tortures, no shrieks, no screams, and it sort of sounds like, from the description, it's a nice place. It's a place that's called Limbo, and it is a place here where Dante meets up with folks we usually call the virtuous pagans. And, also very importantly, one of the permanent residents here is in fact the guy that's temporarily released to be Dante's guide. That is to say, this is Virgil's dwelling in the afterlife.
Now, this, you know, sometimes I like to think of the vestibule, the canto that we've just seen, as hell with an asterisk, and then canto four, circle one here, as hell with a double asterisk, because as Bill suggests, one of the things that separates this is from all of the other places that we're going to see is that there really is no punishment as such. But it's also interesting to think about this as different from other places in hell, is that there's a very interesting thing that takes place a long time ago that affects the people who used to be there and who aren't there any longer. In other words, this is the only place in hell where it was not eternal, where there was a kind of holding pattern for folks who were there for a while and who are not there now and who have, in fact, gone up to heaven. So it's sort of like there are two classes of people here, those virtuous pagans who look like they're going to spend eternity here, and the folks who used to be here but aren't anymore.
There's a story that really isn't biblical, but nevertheless comes out of some early Christian teaching that says when Christ died on the cross, he went down into hell and released the faithful Jews. It's called the harrowing of hell. And it's often depicted in medieval art with Christ coming down there, knocking down the door, trampling on a demon, and holding onto the hands of Adam and Eve with other faithful Jews lined up behind. In fact, Dante names a whole crowd of faithful Jews who were let out. So this great exception to the rule of abandon all hope, you who enter here, is in fact told. After all, Virgil died in 19 BC, and as he said, I was a fairly recent resident here when that happened.
And so the question is, what particular importance does that have to the story as it relates to Dante's own journey? One way to take a look at it is that the pattern of Christ coming down into hell and then rising up again really is the pattern of Dante's own journey. In other words, Dante is doing precisely what, in this story, Christ did while he was in the tomb. He comes down, he leads others out. Well, Dante, of course, is not going to lead anybody else out, except in a kind of metaphorical way, where you can think about the poem itself as Dante taking souls out of hell, taking them out of tendencies towards sin that they might have had. But again, it shows you that there's a kind of exception to the rule in this particular circle that we're not going to see in any other place in hell, but it's a good way to have us think about the fact that Dante, the poet, builds systems and then shows us exceptions to the systems that he builds. It's one of the patterns that we'll see in other parts of the Commedia as well.
Dante has exciting experiences here in Limbo, where the punishment, we're told, really is that those who are here live on in desire for the highest things, which of course in the Christian scheme is God, but live on without hope. Nevertheless, they're not screams and tortures, and Dante meets up and has a sort of pleasant conversation with a number of poets, including Homer. And then Dante sort of introduced around to a whole array of important classical figures. Some of the ones you would most expect would be here: Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, Cicero, Julius Caesar, some less famous figures as well. But also, interestingly enough, because we tend to think about these as folks who, after all, died before Jesus came and therefore didn't have any knowledge, if they weren't Jews, even of the coming of Jesus. But there are also three medieval Muslim figures here, which again reminds us that this scheme is more complex than it might seem. It's not easy to reduce anything Dante does to a one-liner.
And what makes things even more complicated is that we're going to see in other parts of the Commedia pagans as well. So this is the first of Dante's dealing with the very, very difficult problem of salvation for non-believers.